some reason I thought there was one more piece that we had kind of left to finish this week. So just to kind of summarize, I guess, what the Perek does for us, the Perek is really divided up into two parts. It's Perek Lamed. I'm missing a few people. I hear somebody.
Sunny usually comes a little late.
Right.
And that guy
is Sylvia coming?
She said she was going to be out of town. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So the Perek is divided up very clearly into two parts, sort of a framework story that sets out a kind of a foundation or framework of the background, which is the story of David and his conflict with his and his soldiers, dividing his soldiers into two groups, those who can pass through, those who can't, goes to the fact the battle, comes back, and then he has to divide up the spoils of war, and he has a conflict with his men as to how to divide those spoils. David, who insists that they that everybody gets an equal portion, because they all benefited from the campaign, they were part of one army, and so he establishes a law or a principle of kechelak hayared b'melchama ukechelak hayoshev al hakelim yachdav yachloku. Those who go into battle, those who remain to watch the utensils, to watch the camp, they shall divide the spoils equally. A foundational principle how you pay your soldiers, which has continued to most armies till today. And not every soldier in every army is going to be a frontline officer, but in the context of seeing everybody as participating equally in the overall goal of the army. So that was a chiddush. That was what David introduces into the context. In the meantime, separate from that, the middle part of the story is, of course, the story of the Battle of Amalek. And the Battle of Amalek, or the Second Battle of Amalek, let's call it, because the first was, of course, Shaul. And so it gives us an opportunity to compare where Shaul and where David looked at Amalek differently. Shaul looked at them as an army, Shaul looked at them as a nation, fight the army, capture the king, and you're done. Right? David understood that is not the issue here. The issue is that you have a group of nomadic tribes that are slave traders and that are a threat to the people. It's clearly as evidence for the fact that they attacked an innocent city and an unprotected city and captured all of the women and children. Goes and he fights against Amalek in a massive campaign that takes 2 days and ultimately eliminates more or less the threat of Amalek. In the midst of all of that, there's another story. Right? So you have the battle with Amalek, which is the major story, and we have these two side stories. What are the two side stories? The first side story is David and the issue of how to divide the shalal. And then you have a second side story, which is that as they're running towards Amalek, they find this Nebuch, this guy, dying of hunger and thirst on the side of the road, and they stop to give him food and water. Turns out, he's a Na'am Mitzri, he's an Egyptian who had been captured by Amalek, and he got sick, so they dropped him at the side of the road, and they ask him for a little bit of, he gives them some food, and then they ask him if they would identify the troop or the gedud that had captured that attacked Ziklag, and he willingly does so. So in the midst of all of this, if I were to look at the theme that runs through this story from the very beginning, right? David running after his to recapture his people, the challenge that he has with his men being divided, the Na'ar HaMitzri that they stop and provide food for and some water and then ask who he is and discover that he's there, that he has the potential to help them. The attack on Amalek, then comes back to his people and he provides the booties of war, the bounties of war, but he divides them equally. So if I had to look at the subtext of what's the thread that's linking all the pieces of the story together, I think it's a fascinating contrast between, remember, who they're fighting. Who is David fighting in this battle?
Amalek.
And if there's a trademark to Amalek, if there's a characteristic trademark to who and what Amalek is,
hopefully the opposite of us.
Right? So I think that's what's highlighted in this parak more than anything else. And if there's a characteristic trademark of Amalek,
what is it?
Right? No mercy, but also the exploitation of the weak and the defenseless.
Right.
Right. The exploitation of the weak and the defenseless. What the Torah describes is Vayizanev v'chakol ha'necha shalim acharecha. Amalek were attacked from behind and captured all of the, or attacked all of the weak and the stragglers.
And then leaving this man over
here. And here you see it more explicitly. So what's missing in the Torah is that you don't get the background to Amalek. You just hear Vayavo Amalek v'yilachem b'yifidim. Amalek comes and attacks. Lots of people attacked, lots of nations attacked. We had lots of campaigns, military battles over the course of the 40 years in the desert. But none of them carry the weight that the Torah attributes to Amalek when the Torah establishes a principle that Amalek is an eternal enemy. So the trademark...
talk about that they make their, that's how they make their parnasa.
Correct. And that's why it's so characteristic that they're slave traders. That's exactly where the morality or the lack of morality in the context of slave trading is so evident. So that's Amalek. This capture, kidnap the weak and the stragglers, because then you can sell as slaves, and that's how you make your parnasa.
Don't you get more for the strong ones though?
Yeah, but the strong ones also require greater effort and campaign. So it's much easier to go for you'll forgive the expression, the low hanging fruit.
But you got children and women, and that people buy them for different purposes. So.
So that's Amalek. And you see it here much more than you see in the Chumash. I often, when I teach the story of Amalek and Chumash, I'll often jump to Perek Lamed and Shmuel, because you don't really understand Amalek in the Torah unless you see Amalek here. And you realize, how they operate, what kind of people they are, what they're doing. And then you have this little episode of this Mitzri who is abandoned on the side of the road. And in one story, you get the full flavor of what it means to be Amalek. On the flip side, in the same story, you also get a window into what it means to be David and what it means to be part of David's world. Because when they stop to provide, to give food and water to this Egyptian, they don't do it because they think he's going to lead them to...
They feel bad for it.
They don't do it because they think, oh, here's a guy who can help us find where this goods. They don't know who he is. They just see some guy abandoned on the side of the side of the road, and they stop, and they give him food and they give him water, and they're on the chase to hot pursuit of whoever it was who attacked Ziklag, and they may not yet know who it was, and yet they're going to stop to provide this abandoned person on the side of the road, lechem and mayim, some food and water, and then only after they give him food do they ask him, okay, so who are you and who are you from? And turns out that he's their key to
finding
and attacking and destroying Amalek. So the contrast between the little episode with this Nar Mitzri that David and his people identify, that contrasted with the story of Amalek, and you get a really good picture of the core principles that drive David, right? The care for the Nar Mitzri, the care for all of his soldiers, what's the expression? The notion that everybody's going to have an equal share, to treat everybody with fairness. Right? The character trait of David that emerges so dramatically from the story, and of his people, is in direct contrast to the story of Amalek. You couldn't pick a better contrast to highlight who David is and who Amalek is than juxtaposing these two episodes in and around the battle with Amalek. That's not an accident. I mean, that's exactly what this parak is trying to do. He's trying to identify the difference between Amalek on the one hand and David on the other. And in this story, David really emerges as the new Melech, because this is the same night that Shaul is going to be fighting
Amalek.
Plishtim on Har Gilboa, which means that, and we know that that is going to be the end of Shaul's life. So it's a transitional moment. And Shaul, for having failed to kill Amalek back in Perek Tedvav, is going to eventually, is now dying on this battle against the Plishtim, while David, who successfully eliminates Amalek as a threat, is going to emerge in this story as essentially as the new king, because Perek Lamed Aleph are going to go back to Gilboa and read the battle, and Perek and Shmuel Bet is already after post Shaul, and now David emerges as appointed as the new king. So here's your transitional moment: Shaul falling on Har Gilboa, David successfully eradicating Amalek and emerging as the new king. The foundation of David's Malchus being the chesed that he extends to the Na'am Mitzri, the foundation, the opposite of the opposing factor to Amalek, who is who are the ones who are capturing or taking advantage of the innocent, the Vayezanebacha kol anecha shalim acharecha. So the parak is an extraordinary picture of all of the pieces of the puzzle. More or less, I think that's where we left off. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, that brings us to our last parak. That's it. So, yeah, as I said, we'll either, if we finish this parak today, then we will, and this will be our last class. If not, we'll have one more. Maybe we'll have one more just for the sake of bringing it all to a close, but we'll see. All right. Uflishtim nilchamim b'Yisrael. Perek Lamed Aleph. Uflishtim nilchamim b'Yisrael. That in itself is an interesting phrase. The Plishtim are fighting against Israel. What does that mean? Why is that odd?
Because they actually go into Israel?
No, because grammatically, it's just an odd phrase, right? You would normally say, Vayilachamu Plishtim b'Yisrael.
Right.
They fought. Vayilachamu plishtim yisrael. Uflishtim nilchamim, the nifal case, form of the verb. The plishtim were fighting against Israel. It's not the typical, right, not the typical form of how you would present a story in Tanakh, unless you're not telling me here that the plishtim then went and fought Israel, but what you're telling me is
it was ongoing.
Right, that we're going back to a previous story. That in the meantime, back on Har Gilboa, the Plishtim were engaged in a battle against Israel. In other words, it's the typical, this is a very technical biblical grammar rule, but it's a critical one. The normal use of verb tenses in Tanakh, it's confusing because it's not the way we use verb tenses in modern Hebrew. Right. But in biblical Hebrew, verb tenses are often, I would say more often than not, identified by the future tense, or one, if you're describing events of the past, a future tense with a grammatical reversal of the use, right, what we call the vav ha'ipuch. Okay, this vav that changes future tense to past tense. Vayomer, vayidaber, vayochal, the eight, he spoke, he said. We talked about this vav very many times because one of my peeves in life is not to translate it as an and, right? It's not a conjugate, it's not a connector, it's part of the grammatical structure of the verb. That's usually followed by the subject of the verb. So vayidaber Hashem al Moshe, God spoke. In English you'd reverse it, put the subject before the verb. When you are identifying this kind of future tense with a past reversal vav, you put the subject after the verb. So it's Vayedaber Hashem. If you were describing, now, that form of verb usage is always used when you want to describe events in sequence. Events in sequence, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. You're describing in the past, but events in sequence, that's the verb tense you would use. And that's why it's so common in Tanakh, because more or less it's describing events of the past, it's describing history, so it's telling us events as they occurred. So my classic example is Esav and Yaakov by the birthright when he's eating the soup. Vayochal, vayesht, vayakom, vayelech, vayivez, Esav et habuchora. And so classic because it's five verbs in a row. Vayochal, vayesht, vayakom, vayelech, vayivez, Esav et habuchora. He ate, he drank, he got up, he left. He despised the birthright. All of that is a description of Esav. And most translations will go, and he ate, and he drank, and he got up, and he left, and just kind of, because it just flows to translate that verb. But really what it's doing grammatically is dramatically identifying sequence of events. Vayochal, vayesht, vayakom, vayelech, vayivez. Ate, he drank, he got in sequence. Here, you don't have that. If you were to describe that, you would have said Vayilachamu Plishtim VaYisrael, which we've had so many times. Right? If just any sentence in Tanakh, look at Pasuk Bet, Vayadbaku Plishtim et Shaul. The Plishtim caught up to Shaul, caught right. Vayadbaku. They connected. They Vayadbaku. They connected to them. From the word devek, right? They capture them, or they didn't actually capture them, but they engage with them. Vayaku plishtim et Yonatan, the plishtim smote Yonatan, and so on. Vatichbad the mechama, the campaign was heavy. These are verbs in sequence. So this opening phrase should be Vayilachamu yis plishtim b'Yisrael, the plishtim engaged in war against Israel. But that's not what it says. One of those rare instances where the Torah uses, where the Navi uses, a different verb form. In this case, nif'al, but past tense. Nilchamim, or actually present tense. Right? The plishtim are engaging with Israel. Nilchamim b'Yisrael. Why? Because it's the simplest way to explain that this is not happening in sequence, but rather
continuation.
It's a continuation. Not only a continuation of this previous story, but in parallel to the chapter we just read. It's happening at the same time. Right? David is down south in Ziklag. Ooh, Plishtim nilchamim b'Yisrael. And way up north, the Plishtim are engaged with Shaul. I can't write them in sequence. Right? Tanakh doesn't write things in parallel, right, in columns. But I can describe it by saying, okay, now take us back one day and come back to the campaign in the north, which is exactly the same time that David is fighting in the south. That's why it's so dramatic.
Meanwhile,
right. That's exactly right. It's a silent meanwhile. Uflishtim nilchamim b'Yisrael. Vayanusu anshei Yisrael mipnei plishtim. The Israelites fled before the plishtim. Vayiplu chalalim b'har hel Gilboa. And they were falling on Har Gilboa. Vayad beku plishtim et Shaul vet benav. Plishtim, I guess, caught up to Shaul and his sons. Vayaku plishtim et Yonatan vet Avinadav vet Malkishua b'nei Shaul. Three of his sons were identified here, Yonatan, Avinadav, and Malkishua, all are smitten in this battle. Vatichbad hamilchama el Shaul. Campaign was heavy. Vayim tsa'u hamorim anashim bakashet. And the sharpshooters of the arrow, right, those who shoot the arrow, caught up with Shaul. Vayachel ma'od mehamorim. Okay. Gail. What does the art school translate that phrase as? Vayacha ma'od hamorim, mehamorim. The end of verse 3.
The battle bore down heavily against Shaul.
Mm-hmm.
The archers, the men with bows, found him.
Mm-hmm.
And Shaul was terrified of him.
Terrified. Vayachel ma'od me'amarim. Shaul was terrified of the archers. How does the Jerusalem Bible translate
it? He was greatly in dread of the archers.
In dread. Okay. Good. We have a unanimous, you have a consensus amongst the translators. All right. We'll come back to it. Vayomar Shaul nosekilav. Shaul turned to his armor bearer, and he said to him, Shlof charbacha v'dakreni ba. Take out your sword and spear me through. Pen yavo ha'arelim ha'ele udkaruni, lest these uncircumcised, which is again one of those pejorative descriptions of the plishtim, come, which we had way back in Shoftim, the days of Shimshon, right? Well, lest they come and they will attack me, they will spear me, and they will eat aluluvi, have their way with me, mock me. So what's he asking his now to do?
Kill him.
His lad did not want to do it. He was, you're right, he was afraid. Meaning, who was afraid? Who was anointed? Well, we're not talking about David, we're talking about Shaul. Who's afraid?
The armor bearer.
The armor bearer, right? This young lad. He's, Shaul is king. He's asking him to kill him. Ridiculous. So Shaul took his own sword and fell upon it. When this lad saw that Shaul died, he also fell on his sword. Shaul, his three sons, and his armor bearer, all five of them, died. All of those people together. It's unclear whether they all fell on the sword. Possibly, I think that's the implication of this pasuk. When the Israelites on the other side of the valley, remember, Emek Yisrael is the big valley. So on the other side of the valley, or on the other side of the Yarden, north, east, saw that Israel was fleeing from the Plishtim, v'chimetu Shaul v'anav, and that the king had died, v'yazvu ta'arim v'anusu. So they abandoned their cities and they fled, in prediction of what Shmuel had said to Shaul, that not only would this be your fault, but this would be a critical moment in terms of the victory for the Plishtim. Vayanusu vayavo Plishtim. Sorry, vayazu etarim vayanusu vayavo Plishtim vayeshu behem. And those cities now changed hands to Israelite, to Plishtim control. Vahimi mocharat, the day after the battle. At that little pause in the break in the paragraph before Pasukah tells me that the campaign is over. The dust is settling. Next day, vayimi mocharat. Very common practice. What did the soldiers who were victorious would go and they would take the spoils off the bodies of the fallen. And they discover what they never anticipated. The bodies of Shaul and his three sons, the king and the three princes. Vayichritu et rosho. Now, why did they cut off his head?
Didn't we cut off Goliath's head?
Right. It doesn't tell us anywhere that there's the kind of a retribution going on, but you can't escape the imagery. Right. The last major battle that we were victorious in was the Battle of Goliath, when David cut off Goliath's head. Mm-hmm. Right? So Vayichlatu at Rosho. Vayavshitu at Kelav. They took off his armor. Vayishalachu be'eretz plishtim saviv levaser bet atzabem ve'etam. And they sent the armor and the symbols of this victory to all of the houses of worship and gatherings of the people of the Eretz Plishtim. This was a great celebration. Vayasimu et kilav beit ashtarot. They placed the armor on display in their temple. Ve'et gviyato taku b'chomat Beit Shan. And the body of Shaul they stuck on top of the wall in Beit Shan, although headless body. Vayishmu elav yoshvei yevesh gilad. Such a chilul Hashem. You can think about the context here. King of Israel, body beheaded, thrown on the wall, the armor sitting in the temple. The bizayon here, the chilul Hashem here. Can you imagine if they would have found him alive? People of Yavesh Gilad heard et asher asu plishtim l'Shaul, all that they had done to Shaul. Vayakumu kol ish chayil, vayalchu kol alayla. So people of Yavesh Gilad is on the other side of the Yarden, in the land of Jordan today. They came, they went all night long, traveled all the way down. Vayakhu et gviyat Shaul v'et gviyat banav mechomat Beit Shan. And they went up to that wall, Beit Shan, and they took out the bodies of Shaul and his sons. Vayavo Yavesha, and they took him out to Yavesh Gilad. And there, Vayisurafu Tamsham, they burnt them. It's unclear if they burnt the bodies. Some Mefarshim say they burnt the bodies because they were so decomposed that there was nothing else to do with them. They'll bury the bones. Vayikut Atzmotehem, Vayikbru Tachat Ha'esho B'Yavesh, and they buried the bones. Others suggest that they burnt sort of the clothing, because that's what you do for somebody who's like a king, right? There's a ceremonial burning of the armor and an incense and kind of a burial of kings, so to speak. But the actual bodies were buried. Vayatzumu shivat yamim. They fasted for 7 days. Another source for the minhag of Shiva. Right, 7 days of mourning. And that's the end of the story.
Did they get the heads?
No, it's unclear. It doesn't say so. It's not clear what they did with the head.
Yavesh Gilad.
Right. So let's talk about. Let's start from the back. Let's start from the end of the story. Let's talk about Yavesh Gilad
it's
first.
It's like an echo, and I'm like blanking, like, okay, I know that.
Correct. So we actually talked about this a while ago when we first time we read this parak. Yavesh Gilad is not an accident here. Right? Now, of all the people, of all the places that came to save the dignity of Shaul, Yavesh Gilad is the furthest. Right? Shaul is down in. Right? The body is down in the Eretz Plishtim, and Yavesh Gilad is out in Jordan. Why are they coming down to help them? I see. Yavesh Gilad is not an accident. Yavesh Gilad is very targeted.
Was that
Yavesh Gilad is mentioned in the story of Pilagish Begiva, but their connection to Shaul is
not
from there. Their connection to Shaul is much more recent. Right? Yavesh Gilad was the very first city that Shaul campaigned to defend.
Way back, well, before he was king. Right?
Correct. Before he was king. Back in Perek Yud Aleph, I believe.
3 years ago.
Yep. Perek Yud Aleph. There you go. Just take a quick glance back at Perek Yud Aleph.
What
from the beginning. Vayal Nachash Amoni. Remember, Shaul was appointed king. He sort of has a very unceremonial ceremony at the beginning. Right? He's anointed king, and they bring him, and Shaul stands before the people, and he says, "Here's your king." And he's hiding. He doesn't want to be the king, so he's kind of hiding out in the baggage, the nechbal akilim. And Shaul's met with a lot of opposition. Those who don't think that he's fit to be king. Well, that's in Perek Yud. Then we get to Perek Yud Aleph. Vayal Nachash Ha'amoni Vayichan Al Yavesh Gilad. Amon. Again, geographically, Amon Moav on the other side of the Yarden. Yavesh Gilad is an outpost, Israelite settlement outpost in the midst of the Gilad. on the other side of the Yarden. V'yamru kol anshei Yavesh Gilad, they're attacked by this Nachash from Ammon, king of Ammon. And the people of Yavesh Gilad said to them, Kot lanu brit v'navdeka. Okay, we can't fight you. We are unable to defend ourselves. What are your terms of surrender? V'yomar alehem Nachash Ammoni, b'zot echrot lachem bin kol lachem kol ayin yamin v'samti echerpa al Yisrael. Okay, Yisrael. I'll accept unconditional surrender when you hand me your right eye, every one of you. Maim you as slaves and prevent you from ever fighting against me. Take out your right eye and send it to me. V'yemu elav ziknei avesh, heref lanu shivat yamim v'nishlacham malachim b'chogbu Yisrael v'im ein moshiyo tanav yetzanu elecha. We spent a lot of time talking about this verse. Right? The response was, give us 7 days to see if there's somebody who can fight against you and defeat you, otherwise we'll surrender. Which is an odd way to respond to a threat. Give us 7 days to see if we can kill you, and if not, we'll surrender. I suspect that that's not what they told Nachash ben Ammon. What I think they told him was, give us 7 days. And then the Navi parenthetically tells us what's their thought process, right? Their thought process is to see if they can find somebody who will save them. Pasuk Dalid, Vayavo Hamalachim Givat Shaul. Vayedabru Adonim Bozneh Am. Came, the messengers of Yavesh Gilad came to Givat Shaul and spoke these words to the people, meaning they reported to the people exactly what Nachash had threatened them. Vayis'u Kola Amet Kolam Vayivku. The response of the people, they cried, which is very moving. They were very moved by their tale. But that's not really the response that they expected. What response did they expect?
That they would come help them.
That they would come help. V'hinei Shaul ba acharei Lo and behold, Shaul walks up from his day out in the fields with his flock. V'yomer Shaul ma'al ha'am ki yivku. And he sees everybody crying, so he inquires, he says, why are you all crying? V'yisaplu lo et divrei anshei Yavesh. So they told him. V'titzlach ruach elokim al Shaul, spirit of divine. Remember how we translated this phrase from Sefer Shoftim, right? Divinely inspired courage. The spirit of God came upon Shaul, embraced him, enveloped him in courage. Kishamo tadurim eile, v'yichar apo ma'od. He was angry. V'yikach tzemed bakar v'yinatcheu. He took a pair of oxen, cut them up into pieces. And he sent them throughout the borders of Israel, north and south, saying, if you don't follow me now into battle, thus shall be done to your cattle. Which is another way of saying, thus shall be done to you. Fear of God embraced them, a.k.a. fear of Shaul. And they all came out as one. Now, there's a lot of imagery here that's very intentional. Ki'ish echad, they all came out as one, is an exact paraphrase of the phrase that describes how they fought against the tribe of Binyamin back in the story of Pelegesh Begiva. Ki'ish echad chaverim. When all the tribes united to eradicate the tribe of Binyamin. That story was in the aftermath of the Pelegesh Begiva story, which is when this man had cut up the Pelegesh into pieces and sent a piece of her throughout the borders of Israel to say, this is what happened to my Pelegesh, right? And brought them all to fight against Binyamin. And in that fight, when they realized that it wasn't going to be so easy to fight against Binyamin, they went and discovered that Yavesh Gilad had stayed neutral on that campaign, and so there was a sidebar at that moment back in the end of Shoftim, which they went and they killed everybody in Yavesh Gilad. So Yavesh Gilad is mentioned 3 places in Tanakh. It's actually one more, but for now it's 3 places. Pelegesh Begiva, where they were killed by the rest of the tribes of Israel because they stayed neutral regarding Binyamin. Here, where Shaul gathers the forces of Israel, Shaul from Shevet
Binyamin,
to go and defend Yavesh Gilad when nobody else will, partially in acknowledgement and Havakar Satov to them for their loyalty to Binyamin for all those years. And at the end of Shaul's life, when Shaul has been so disgraced, who comes to provide the dignity of burial to Shaul HaMelech? The people of Yavesh Gilad will never forget what Shaul did for them back in Perek Yud Aleph. An extraordinary connection between one part of the story and the next. Let's go.
Did other people know what had happened to Shaul and just didn't do anything about it? Or did they not?
I assume if it was knowledge, I mean, Yavesh Gilad. You just lost a major campaign to the Plishtim. Whole swaths of the land of Israel taken over by the Plishtim, and they've taken the body back into Eretz Plishtim. Who's going to go and fight that? Who's going to go and you know?
I think it's so sad that Yonatan, he was so good.
Yonatan's fate is sealed the moment he chose to go with Shaul and not follow David. The moment he made that choice, he sealed whatever fate would befall Shaul would befall him. That was clear to Yonatan, that was clear to David. He says so explicitly in the Shira, in the Kina, in Perek Aleph, in Shmuel Bet, when he talks about Shaul and Yonatan, Karayot, Shaul v'Yonatan hane'ahavim v'hane'imim b'chayehem uv'motam lo nifradu. Shaul and Yonatan, connected in life, connected in death. The moment he chose to stay with, at that fateful moment, way back in Perek, whatever it was, right, at that fateful moment when Yonatan chose to stay with Shaul and send David on his own, Yonatan essentially sealed his fate with whatever would happen to Shaul, consciously. Loyalty of a son to his father, but nonetheless, that is part of the story. Yeah. Which brings us back to the question of Shaul in this perek. So I want to come back to the beginning of the perek. Let's come back to Perek Lamed Aleph. And there's a great deal of discussion in the halachic literature of Jewish history about the question of the called the halachic parameters to the Shaul suicide, right, falling on his sword. I'm not going to get into that piece of the story because it's really it's more complex than I think we need to look at it for now. But I do want to come back to Pasuk Gimel.
Is this the first time that a Jew falls on a sword or no?
I don't know. I mean, we have the case in Sefer Shmuel, in Sefer Shoftim, by I think it's Avi Melech, where he doesn't want it to be said that a woman killed him, so he has the Na'ar kill him with the sword. But there he does it, right, without hesitation. Here, not so fast. But I want to come back to Pasuk Gimel. V'tichbadim mechamel Shaul v'yimtzu hamorim anashim bekashet. Vayachel meod me'amorim. Perek Lamed Aleph, back to Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Gimel. Vayachel meod me'amorim. Shaul was. How do you translate it?
In dread of the archers.
Now, if Shaul is in dread of the archers, that's a window into. Right, that tells us a great deal about what's going on. I'm gonna pass it down. What's going on in Shaul's mind? Right. I mean, this story reflects the whole piece here hinges on how I translate this word. Vayachel meod me'amorim. He was greatly in fear or in dread of the archers, and therefore pasuk dalet vayomer Shaul nasei kilav shlof charbacha v'dakreni va. Take your sword and kill me. What's the fear? What's the rationale? What's driving Shaul's request to be to his Noseg Kelav to spear him through, to drive him through with, and to kill him?
I think that he's going to be tortured and maimed and...
He's afraid.
He knows he's going to die, but...
He's afraid. Vayachah ma'od mi'amarim. He is afraid. And that is clearly reflected in Pasuk Gimel. Vayachah ma'od mi'amarim. Vayomer Shaul. The juxtaposition of those two statements. Greatly in dread, fear, trepidation. Take a look at the Targum. Udechil, in the source page I just gave you, source 1. Udechil lachada mikashtaya. Udechil is chil u'rada, trembling in fear. Radak, inyan chil u'pachad. He hasn't yet been injured, and yet he is afraid. Every one of them are farshim in the footsteps of the Targum and the translators translate this phrase "vayachal" as he was afraid, which fits into the context. Remember, what has been the driving force of Shaul ever since the aftermath of the Battle of Amalek, which says that Hashem sar me'alav, right? Back in Yavesh Gilad, it says that that act of courage was inspired by the Spirit of God coming upon him, batitzlach alav ruach halokim. Every time he experiences one of these moments of melancholy or depression or fear or paranoia, it's driven by this Vashem Sar Me'alav, the absence of that divine courage and inspiration. So that fear has been driving Shaul into his attack on David, into his pursuit of David, into everything that has essentially driven Shaul's campaign into the ground. So it's no surprise, therefore, that the story ends with a moment of extraordinary fear and weakness where he turns to his Nara and he says, kill me, because I'm afraid to be captured by the Plishtim. That's how classically and typically this pasuk has been translated.
So could I just be a Barbanel
over here? Oh yeah, Barbanel says differently?
Well, he says he was afraid...
He's looking for somebody that says something else.
He wasn't afraid of dying. He said he was afraid he would be wounded, but remained alive, and then the police team would parade him around and use his capture to desecrate the name of God.
Okay. At least he redeems a little bit of the fear. Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to offer an alternative reading, because I'm very bothered by the suggestion that this whole perek is a description of Shaul's fear. Fear of dying, fear of being prayed by the Plishtim, fear of being desecrated, whatever the fear is, I'm bothered by the sense that this perek revolves around Shaul's fear. Why am I bothered by it? It would make sense if it was any other perek in the story. This one bothers me. Why? Besides the fact that it's the last story we're going to read about Shaul, so it leaves a bad taste in our mouth. But besides that, there's a lot of... If he was really afraid, then what would he have done? Put yourselves into his shoes. I don't think he would have surrendered so fast.
Well, he was afraid he'd be abused.
If he was really afraid, what would he have done?
Go to the end of, go behind all the other men.
And do what?
Hide.
Okay, take that one step further.
Slip away, baby.
Not go in the first place. Mm-hmm. Remember, he's been told
he's going to lose.
That he's not only going to lose this battle, he's been told he's going to die on the battlefield. Shmuel came to him and said to him, tomorrow at Machar Ata'iti, you are going to die on the battlefield. If you're really afraid, now I hear the intensity of battle can sometimes can very often create a sense of fear and trepidation that just knowing about the battle in advance can't do. So maybe he's has enough courage to go into battle, and then he's gripped by fear. Maybe. But he's been in battle so many times. This is not a novice.
He was a warrior king.
He was a warrior. This is not something new to him. If he was really afraid, v'yachel ma'od, then why go into battle in the first place? The fact that he's here, the fact that he's standing there, first of all, it takes courage to an extent to be able to anticipate that you don't want to be captured by your enemies, and therefore you want to you're going to ask your nosekilav to kill you or to fall on your own sword. That's not just because, and the way it's described, because he doesn't want to be captured by the plishtim. Even the suggestion that he's afraid to be captured, which is a barbanel, doesn't fit the words, because the words are vayacha ma'od mehamorim. He was afraid of the archers. And it doesn't say he was afraid of the plishtim. It doesn't say he was afraid to be captured. It says he was afraid of the archers. I'm bothered by that. I don't know, it just doesn't sit well with me. And I would have left it unsaid, except for the fact that I did find an alternative. I like the alternative. I like it a lot better than suggesting that he was afraid. We have two other instances in Tanakh in very similar circumstances of a king who goes into battle and who is wounded by archers and who dies in battle. First is in Sefer Melachim Aleph Perek Chavet. I've given you the two sources on the page. The first is Achav. And by Achav it says the following. V'ish mashach bakashet letumo. In that battle, there's a lot of parallels between Shaul and Achav in that battle. I'm not going to go into them. Both battles are predicated by a Navi who tells the king he's going to die in battle. Right? Shmuel who tells Shaul, and Michayu who tells Achav he's going to die in battle. Goes anyway. In Achav's case, he disguises himself by wearing non-royal clothes. He takes the clothes. He takes the uniform of a regular soldier. And so it says, "V'ish mashach b'kesha l'tumo." Some guy was sitting there with a bow and arrow. He didn't know who he was shooting at because he thought he didn't know he was shooting at the king. He just thought he was shooting l'tumo innocently. Right, he was one of the others. Vayaket melech Yisrael ben hadavakim uven hashiryan. And this arrow found itself literally in, there's always weak points in an armor, because between the shoulder and the back plate, you're going to have, right, in order for the arm to move, so you have a section of the armor that's not that's not connected, and so you have a weak link, and that's into that space, which is not protected by armor, the arrow found its mark. Now, Achav says the following: Vayomer lirakavo. He turns to his chariot rider, meaning to the Rechav Yisrael Ufarashav, the one who's driving the chariot, and he says to him, Hafoch yadcha v'hotzieni min ha-machaneh. Turn around and take me out of the camp. Ki hacholeti, because I have been injured. Min lashon chole, right? Sick. Batalei ha-machama b'yom ahu. The war continued, the battle continued on that day. Listen to what happens. V'yamelech haya ma'omad b'merkava nochach aram. The king insisted that they not remove him completely, but that they stood him up in his chariot opposite the army of Aram all day long. For what purpose? He's wounded. He's got a sword in it. He's got a arrow in his back. And they prop him up in his chariot on a hill so he's not fighting, but he's propped up so that everybody can see him. For the purpose of? Right. So that the people shouldn't lose heart and thereby lose the battle. And in so doing, Vayamot Ba'erev, he dies that night because he bleeds to death. Vayitzok Dam Hamaka El Chekarachev. Achav dies a hero's death. Achav is a very complicated personality in Tanakh. Please God, we'll get to Sefer Melachim one day and we'll learn all about Achav. Right? Achav is a very complicated personality because on the one hand he's this idolatrous king, on the other hand his loyalty and his leadership as a king, as a military leader, is unparalleled. And you see it here. He's wounded, but in order to ensure that Israel doesn't lose the battle, he literally has them prop him up in his chariot all day long so that people should think he's still alive and continue the campaign opposite Aram, and thereby and that's how he dies, because he bleeds out. The other instance of a similar kind of situation, although there he doesn't stay in the battlefield, is Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu in his battle with Paro. Vayomer Vayoru Hayorim Lemelech Yoshiyahu. The archers speared or caught Yoshiyahu, the king. Vayomer Hamelech Avadav. So Melech turned to his servants and said, Ha'aviruni, remove me, ki hacholeti me'od, because I am greatly injured. Right? Injured, sick, right? Yeah. Injured from the arrow. Mm-hmm. So in both instances, in the context of battle, because of the spear, because of the arrow that finds its mark, the morim, or the yoru bekeshet, the king is wounded. Ki hacholeti me'od. Now, let's go back to Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Gimel, and again, here I'm going to take issue with the translations. Every one of the translations follows the traditional line of Vayachal, that he was afraid. I'm going to reread that pasuk. V'tichbad milchama el Shaul. The war was intensified. V'yimtzau hamorim anashim bakashet, and the archers found their mark. Vayachel me'od mehamorim, and Shaul was greatly wounded by the archers. In lashon, chole ki ocholeti me'od. And if that's the translation, and I think it fits, right? It's not him saying ki ocholeti. It's the Navi telling us vayachel. He was chole. He was wounded. Now the story takes on a different character. Not about his fear, but about his courage. About his willingness to recognize that he was at that moment mortally wounded. Mortally wounded, he has a dilemma. He can't continue to fight. He will be captured. And now he would rather die either by his own sword or by his Nosei Kilav, rather than at the hands of the Plishtim. But it all starts by the question of whether he's acting out of fear or out of courage. Vayachel Ma'od. Is this Perek designed to redeem a little bit of Shaul's character and restore to him the dignity of his death through courage, or to describe his death out of fear? And I don't have an answer to that question. I just have two different versions of the story based on how I translate this one word, Vayachel.
But is this your alternate, or whose alternate?
The first time I saw it was Amnon Bazak's book on Sefer Shmuel has explains it this way. Again, Medan translates it as traditionally as he was afraid. It's a debate amongst the Mefarshim, but amongst contemporary scholars. But I actually think it resonates much more in the context of this, of the overall message of this chapter, given the fact that after his encounter with Balatov, when he crumbles to the ground in fear, and the symbol of that fear is that he's refused to eat, he has no strength, till she turns to him and says, eat something, because you need strength for the battle, and he eats, and he gets up, and he goes, there's this moment of transition where he's accepted his fate, and he goes into battle accepting his fate, well, then why would he be afraid? He's accepted that fate. Why would the Navi turn that around suddenly and describe him as being afraid? Right? It all starts from the fact that he's gone into battle in the aftermath of this experience of Balatov. He's accepted that destiny. He's accepted that fate upon himself. And so when he's wounded in battle, v'yachal ma'od me'amorim. And it doesn't say he's afraid of the plishtim. He's afraid of the archers. He's wounded by the archers. Now, it's a different story. So, to pull this together, I want to share with you a quote from probably the most unlikely source. And it's an odd source with which to bring this course to a close, but nonetheless, I think that is a very powerful one. Josephus has in his book, Antiquities of the Jews, a chapter, he has a whole section describing the story of Shaul and David, book 6, but he has one section where he describes this battle. And he describes Shaul and the courage it takes to go into battle knowing you're going to die. From one warrior to another. Right? This is Josephus writing. Josephus is always a complex personality in Jewish history, but nonetheless, I thought it was so powerful, I just put the whole thing here and I thought we would read it. But he describes the whole story. He's like, literally, it's a chapter of describing the events of this chapter. And then he digresses. But I shall speak farther upon another subject, which will afford me the opportunity of discoursing on what is for the advantage of cities and peoples and nations and suited to the tastes of good men, and encourage them all in the prosecution of virtue as capable of showing them the method of acquiring glory and an everlasting fame, and of imprinting in the kings of nations and the rulers of cities great inclinations and diligence of doing well, as also of encouraging them to undergo dangers and to die for their countries, and of instructing them how to despise all the most terrible adversities. The English teachers in the room will recognize that in the style of writing in those days was very different than it is today. If I wrote a sentence like that in the English composition, I'd probably get a D- for what we would call a run-on sentence. Right? But that's how they wrote. And I have a fair occasion offered to enter on such a discourse by Saul, king of the Hebrews. For although he knew what was coming upon him, and that he was to die immediately by the prediction of the prophet, he did not resolve to fly from death, nor so far to indulge the love of life as to betray his own people to the enemy, or to bring a disgrace on his royal dignity, but exposing himself as well as all his family and children to dangers, he thought it a brave thing to fall together with them, as he was fighting for his subjects, and that it was better his sons shall die thus, showing their courage, than to leave them to their uncertain conduct afterward, while instead of succession and posterity, they gained commendation and a lasting name. Such and one alone seems to me to be a just, a courageous, and a prudent man, and when any one has arrived at these dispositions, or shall thereafter arrive at them, he is the man that ought to be by all honored with the testimony of a virtuous and courageous man. For as to those that go out to war with hopes of success, and that they shall return safe, supposing they should have performed some glorious action, I think those do not do well who call these valiant men, as so many historians and other writers who treat of them are wont to do, although I confess those do justly deserve some commendation also. If you go into battle, you don't know you're going to die. You think you might survive, and you do something heroic. Okay, you want to be called a hero, so be it. I'll grant you some commendation. But those only may be styled courageous and bold in great undertakings and despisers of adversities who imitate Saul. For as those that do not know what the event of war will be as to themselves, and if you don't know what the outcome of the war is going to be, and though they do not faint in it, right, they're not afraid, but deliver themselves up to uncertain futurity, and are tossed this way and that way, this is not so very eminent an instance of a generous mind, although they happen to perform many great exploits. But when men's minds expect no good event, but they know beforehand they must die, and that they must undergo that death in the battle also, after this neither to be affrighted nor to be astonished at the terrible fate that is coming, but to go directly upon it, when they knew it before, when they know it beforehand, that it is that I esteem the character of a man truly courageous. Accordingly, this Saul did, and thereby demonstrated that all men who desire fame after they are dead are so to act as they may obtain the same. This especially concerns kings, who ought not to think it enough in their high station that they are not wicked in the government of their subjects. It's not enough if you be a leader that you're not wicked, that you're not cruel to your people. No, you have to do more. But to be no more than moderately good to them. I could say more than this about Saul and his courage, the subject affording matter sufficient, but that I may not appear to run out improperly in his commendation, I return again to that history from which I made this digression. I love the piece because what is identified is the extraordinary courage it takes to go into battle knowing you're going to die. And in that moment, to describe him as falling on his sword because he was afraid, I'm much more inclined to translate Vayachel as he was wounded, and in that context puts him in the moment of his death in the category of kings like Ahab and Yoshiyahu. And at least at the end of the story, the Sefer gives us an insight or a window into Saul, who manages to raise himself up from the depth of that paranoia that has overwhelmed him over the last 15 chapters, and he dies a hero's death. And not surprisingly, David describes him as having died a hero's death. When we talked about the kina of David, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, now it seems to describe a very different Saul. So for the most of Sefer Shmuel, the Saul that's described, the Saul that's described, doesn't fit the description of that David gives him. A man of courage, a man of war, a man. But that's because it's written by Shmuel and it's written by the Nevi'im, who felt very disappointed by Saul, and rightfully so. But this perek is a description of the courage it takes to accept the decree, accept the gzaidin, go into battle, knowing he's going to die, and refuse to allow himself to be captured alive by the plishtim. When wounded, that's the piece, takes upon himself to fall upon his own sword. It also addresses the halachic complexity of the notion of suicide. But that notwithstanding, I think the primary motivation behind this interpretation is how he reads this parak as all. And with that, we have concluded our study of Sefer Shmuel Aleph.
Yeah, I just realized that.
We have concluded our study of Sefer Shmuel Aleph. And which of course ends with Shaul's death, but at least it's given him somewhat of a hero's death instead of the coward's death. And
I think that's a scene, no?
We should have a scene. So I'll tell you what I'm prepared to do. Why don't we schedule, I'm going to turn this off for now because we don't need the rest of this.